high-quality public radio. If you didn't have a chance to make a pledge, it's never too late to call 217-244-9455 or go to willpledge.org. Thanks.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. We start today in Nigeria. Africa's most populous country is continuing its fight against Boko Haram. That's an extremist group whose name means Western education is forbidden. On Monday, during rush hour, an explosion at a busy bus station outside the capital of Abuja killed at least 70 people. Nigeria's president, Goodluck Jonathan, who visited the scene, placed the blame squarely on Boko Haram's shoulders. And fingers are again pointed at the group after heavily armed men reportedly kidnapped more than 100 girls from a remote boarding school in the northeastern state of Borno. That's one of three states that have been under emergency rule for almost a year. Here to tell us more is NPR's Africa correspondent, Ofiebio Quist-Arkton. And also with us is Chika Odowa, a freelance journalist based in Abuja. Welcome to both of you.
Greetings from Dakar.
Ofiebio, you've covered the activities of Boko Haram for quite some time now. And I understand that last July, the leader of the group actually called for more schools to be targeted. What is behind this particular tactic of targeting schools and either killing students or kidnapping them?
Indeed, this is the question, because nobody really knows. Shekau comes out with these videos from time to time, and there was an attack on a school. Sometimes, as you've said, students are killed. It's been boys up till now. But very recently, boys had their throats slit like proverbial sacrificial lambs. Girls were spared at a school in another remote boarding school in Borno State. The girls were told, go home, get married, and stop school, stop this Western education. So it's almost like the Taliban in Afghanistan. They are saying no to Western education. But that is an ideology that fits in with Boko Haram having said that it wants to Islamize Nigeria. It wants strict Sharia Islamic law imposed, especially in the predominantly northern part of the country. But then others say they don't seem to have any ideology. Is this all about politics mixed with poverty, mixed with people who want a better life for themselves, so join up with these Islamist groups?
Chika, the latest that we got were that we weren't entirely sure how many students had been kidnapped and how many escaped.
So far, security officials are saying that two or three girls escaped in the Chibok school, and now they're saying that at least 200 girls were actually kidnapped. Where they're being taken, no one knows. But people do suspect that they were probably taken to Boko Haram's encampment. That's what we're hearing right now. Security officials are trying to locate the girls who were abducted on Monday night by armed gunmen. Of course, this attack is, again, as Ofeba said, it is a hallmark of the work of Boko Haram, just judging on what they've been doing in the past.
And obviously the government is pointing fingers at Boko Haram. What else are they saying about this kidnapping?
So far, they haven't said much, but again, this is an unprecedented kidnapping with so many girls, about 200, according to local officials, kidnapped. Parents are taking some of their children out of the school. They're saying that if the government had not been able to provide security, then they don't want their daughters to go to school. So again, this is perhaps the intent of Boko Haram, meaning, of course, Western education is a taboo, is sin.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the security situation in Nigeria after attacks that are being blamed on Boko Haram. And Ofeba, you've reported that many members of this group are young men, and you described them as, quote, no hope, no prospects, no future, desperation, no money. What draws, I mean, obviously, perhaps poverty is the biggest draw, but what else draws them to this group that you say is not ideologically focused?
Or seems not to be. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It is very shadowy. I have only met one. He says he was not a Boko Haram fighter. He was forced into it. He was press ganged into it. That was when I was in Maiduguri, which is really the epicenter and the founding a town where Boko Haram was established back in the early 2000s. Now, this young man said, you know, we hardly mention God's name. We mention God's name when we're getting hungry, and when our leaders realize that we've run out of food, then we go and raid local villages and get food from them. So that hardly squares with we want a purer form of Islam, we want to end corruption, we want to end bad things, and we feel that the Islam that is practiced in Nigeria at the moment is the wrong kind of Islam. So it's very difficult to pin down who exactly these people are. But young boys, young men who have no job prospects and want a meal, a steady job, even if it means picking up a weapon to fight, they seem to be joining them in droves.
And Chika, what about the attitude of the average Nigerian toward Boko Haram? How do they view this group?
The attitude of Nigerian is definitely mixed. Many Nigerians say that this cannot be the work of Nigerian people. They're saying that perhaps these attackers are coming from neighboring countries, perhaps Mali and Chad and Libya, even Cameroon. So there is a sense that this is not being done by Nigerians. On the other hand, if you talk to more pragmatic Nigerians, they say that this could definitely be Nigerians. When you hear many of the attackers, of course, they're shouting, "Allahu Akbar, God is great." But many of them also speak Hausa and Kanuri. Both of these are languages spoken in Nigeria. So just the sense of who these people are, it's still very, very obscure. Again, people are saying if the government can address the poverty in northern Nigeria, give them more development. The youth are largely unemployed. Drug usage is high in northern Nigeria. So many people here say that perhaps if these issues are addressed, then we could see a decrease in attack or perhaps a change of mind in these young people.
Ofebia, there are have been a number of tactics that have been suggested to fight Boko Haram. One is, as Chika just suggested, anti-poverty. Some people have said you have to deal with the group like a terrorist group. Some people say you have to deal with them more like an insurrection. How is the government strategizing to deal with Boko Haram?
It is failing dramatically. It's been almost a year. May last year, the three most remote northeastern states came under emergency rule. A state of emergency was imposed by President Goodluck Jonathan, who then said the military was going to drive out and smoke out the insurgents in what was initially quite a dramatic offensive and crackdown on them. But look what we're left with a year later. In the past 12 months, Boko Haram, or these Islamist groups, have stepped up their attacks. They, on Monday, managed to hit, they haven't claimed responsibility yet, but the finger is pointing at them, this very busy bus station outside Abuja, the capital, with commuters and market traders and everybody trying to get to work, more than 70 people dead. That, of course, has frightened Nigerians. But for almost every week, every other day sometimes, in these northeastern states that are meant to be under emergency rule, they have attacked military installations, remote villages, children in schools. I mean, they seem to be able to attack at will. President Goodluck Jonathan keeps saying, no, we have rooted them out. We have contained them to the northeastern remote area of Nigeria. But then they can strike anywhere. So Nigerians now want the government and the military and the security forces to do more and to make sure that what has become a huge security threat to, as you say, Africa's most populous nation, half Muslim, half Christian, to end this. Because, of course, they have attacked churches and they are also killing Muslims as well as Christians and others.
So, Chika, the attack that Ofebia is describing, I understand that you were actually there on Monday. Do people see this as a destabilizing force, something that actually threatens the power of the government?
Of course, of course. I was at the attack in Nanya, outside of the Abuja city center, when the explosion happened at the motor park. I spoke to many Nigerians who are saying that this, of course, will destabilize the political situation of the country. They're saying that perhaps these people are trying to make it difficult for the government to govern Nigeria. They want to make the government absolutely in a state of chaos, that perhaps the president may have to step down. So many Nigerians see this as a situation that cannot be contained. They're not safe sleeping. People are afraid to go out in their homes. Many people I spoke to were counting the number of bodies that were laying on the ground in the motor park. Many people said that their houses shook. And again, people are just calling for an end to this, and they don't see the government trying to actually establish a state of security at this time.
Let me just chip in here, Celeste, to say, and we mustn't forget that this is just a year ahead of elections in Nigeria. And the election time in Nigeria is always a violent time. So you have some who are suggesting that there are political movements. President Goodluck Jonathan himself has said that he feels that members of even his cabinet and his military are involved with Boko Haram. He fired the whole military hierarchy just a few weeks ago and then got rid of his defense minister. But since then, we have seen, if anything, an escalation in attacks and ferocity and deaths. You know, 3,000 odd in just what, the 3-4 months of this year. So that strategy doesn't seem to be working either. And it looks as if the government is going to have to rethink its strategy.
And to what extent does this affect the neighboring countries or the entire continent of Africa? Or is this simply a Nigerian problem?
It's a zone of instability. As you know, Borno State borders Cameroon, and we're told that Boko Haram fighters come and go across the border. There have been, of course, the abduction, kidnapping of European foreigners just in northern Cameroon, and we're told that they are taken across the border. Very recently, a Canadian nun and 2 Italian priests, but last year, a French family, including 4 children, and a French priest who was released later. So the borders are very porous, and coming and going across that area has caused instability across the region. And then we were told that in Mali, during the occupation of Mali's northern area in a year or so ago, that Boko Haram fighters were involved with the Islamists who occupied the desert north. So this is a destabilizing, in inverted commas, terrorist threat to that whole Sahel region of West Africa.
Ophébia Quistocten is NPR's Africa correspondent. She joined us from her base in Dakar, Senegal. And Chika Odua is a freelance journalist based in Abuja. Thanks to both of you.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up, students in the U.S. get a glimpse of the Rwandan genocide 20 years later, and it leaves some lasting impressions.
When being presented with something so extreme as genocide, part of what we hear from students is, I should just stop complaining.
We hear about the new PBS documentary, Coexist. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee.
On the next Fresh Air, uncovering the story of the man who leaked the NSA's secrets. We talk with Brian Burrow, the lead writer of the new Vanity Fair article about Edward Snowden, called The Snowden Saga, A Shadowland of Secrets and Light. It's based on interviews conducted in several countries, as well as communications with Snowden himself. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering over 1,000 area rugs, hand-knotted, hand-tufted, and power-loomed. Eastern Rug Gallery also offers a professional cleaning and repair service for Oriental and other fine rugs. Located at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. The nation of Rwanda is marking 20 years since a genocide that claimed more than 800,000 lives. And decades after the killing, survivors on both sides are learning how to forgive and how to be forgiven. But it's a complicated, painful process for everyone involved.
Much as we are doing reconciliation, we still have peace spoilers. People want to spoil peace. People who are still diehards. Some people who committed genocide, but up to now, they don't feel remorse for what they did.
That's Fatoumata Ndongjiza, Executive Secretary for the National Unity and Reconciliation Commission of Rwanda. She's one of the voices in the new documentary Coexist, which airs tonight on the PBS World Channel. The filmmakers spoke to Rwandan genocide survivors about the reconciliation process. Now they're bringing the lessons from those experiences to students in the United States. Joining us today is Mishy Lesser. She's the learning director for the Coexist Learning Project, and she was in charge of developing the curriculum. We're also joined by Joni Landrum. She teaches English as a second language at East Hartford High School in Connecticut, and she used this film in a lesson for her students. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So, Mishy, what's the aim of the curriculum? What's the main lesson you're trying to teach students? Clearly, it's not algebra.
We're trying to give students an opportunity to think about colonialism and genocide as a portal to looking at their own lives and experiences in relation to harming others and being harmed by others, forgiving others and being forgiven, dehumanizing certain individuals or a targeted group, or standing up to protect them.
How do you do that? Using a lesson from a country in which people look very different, they dress very differently, not all of them speak English?
Before we show the movie, we start by talking to them about genocide, and we acknowledge that there's genocide deep in the history of our country, that we're not studying Rwanda to point a finger at another people or at another part of the global community, but rather as a way to learn from their experiences in order to conduct this personal inventory. So before they even watch the film, we're using certain techniques to allow them to feel both safe and supported, but also willing to open up. And we begin to introduce the concept of othering, which is really all about a particular group of people being targeted and vilified for mistreatment. And there's not a student in our country, in our classrooms, really, all over the U.S., who hasn't either done this to someone or had it done to them.
Joni, I wonder what's the hardest thing for students to grasp? Out of all the many lessons you could take away from the Rwandan genocide, what do really students have the hardest time understanding?
My class is made up of students from all over the world, and they come here to the United States. The students that I have been here for 3 years or less. So they're new arrivals. I think one of the reasons that Mishy wanted to start with my class was because my students do grasp this pretty easily. They're a marginalized population here at school. They're immediately different, whether they look different, but the fact that they don't speak English perfectly and they have accents when they do speak English. So I think it was fairly easy, and I actually have a couple of students in my class who are from countries in Africa. But I think that once we watch the movie, and then I talk to them about why are we watching this movie, and how does this relate to you? They made that connection pretty quickly.
Let's take a listen to another clip from the film, which kind of relates to this idea of learning how to survive as a marginalized people.
We teach and we spend a lot of time with survivors explaining why forgiveness is a good thing for themselves, not for the offenders, but for their own sake. But once somebody has managed to forgive, you can see that he changes, his heart is transformed, he doesn't look sad, he has a peace.
That's the voice of Reverend Philbert Kalisa, founder of the Rwandan Reconciliation Organization, REACH. Mishy, how do you approach in the curriculum this idea of forgiveness for one's own mental well-being? That's a pretty complicated topic, even for adults to understand.
The testimony that the film contains is really all across the spectrum of forgiving because otherwise I won't be able to go on, to I refuse to forgive. In between those two bookends, you have people who say the most important thing is to ask for forgiveness and apologize. counterposed to people who actually do something, and they don't just speak those words. You have a former perpetrator who learns that the surviving member of his victim's family is homeless, and he builds a home for her and her daughter. And you see how they reconstitute their relationship in the process of him doing that. I'm so glad that you pulled that clip from our film, because as we've worked for the last 7 or 8 months at East Hartford High School in Connecticut, one of the things that the faculty and staff have taught me is that in youth culture, at least at their school, and it may be more universal than that in our country, forgiveness is seen as a weakness. And what we're setting out to do with this movie is to transform that culture so that forgiveness is seen as a choice and potentially a source of strength for those who have been victimized, and also as a first step toward upstanding. So we get students trying to reflect on and write about and talk about, sometimes by sitting in circle, the instances that they've noticed where forgiveness was either given or it was denied, and how that made them feel. This is all sort of part of supporting the development of social emotional literacy.
Joni, I wonder, out of all the responses that you got from students after going through this curriculum and seeing this film, what response really moved you?
We used the documentary as a prompt for a writing project that we did. I got very unique essays from my students because they were telling me the event that happened to them when they needed to forgive or they needed to be forgiven. And then they were telling me how that made them feel. And I really kind of pushed them a little bit. I said, don't tell me that you felt sad, because I know everybody feels sad. I want you to tell me what were your physical reactions to that, what were the thoughts going through your head, you know, all of those kinds of things. I was surprised at how well they expressed themselves with this particular prompt.
And when being presented with something so extreme as genocide, part of what we hear from students is, I should just stop complaining, or I should lighten up when it comes to the grudge that I've been holding, or I should be a little bit more understanding at home to my younger siblings. There's kind of a softening that happens. What was amazing to see with Joni and her students was just the quality of their personal reflection and then how hard they worked to put that into words in this writing project. It was very impressive.
Mishy Lesser is the learning director for the Coexist Learning Project. She spoke to us from WGBH-TV in Boston. Joni Landrum teaches English as a second language at East Hartford High School, and she showed the documentary Coexist to her students as part of a pilot program. She joined us from their classroom. Coexist will air tonight on the PBS World Channel, and it's already available online. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And now we turn to a different form of othering that one writer says is apparent in many of the pictures we see. When Sarita McFadden was a child, she dreaded taking pictures after a family photo made her skin appear dulled and darkened. McFadden wrote about this and the racial bias in photography for BuzzFeed, and she says certain cameras and photographers who are unfamiliar with different shades of skin often distort the images and the colors of black and brown people. Now she's a photographer herself, and the technology has improved and allowed her to capture the many hues of brown skin. She also says photography still has a long way to go. Sarita McFadden joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's go back, just like your piece does, and talk about how we got to this situation, and explain to me when film was first being developed, how it sort of favored Caucasian skin.
In the design of film emulsion technology, a lot of this was conceived with the idea of the best representation of white people. And I don't mean to say that it was a deliberate and exclusionary practice, but much more of a willful obliviousness, if you will. So color film in its early stages pretty much developed around trying to measure the image against white skin.
And in fact, the color card that was often used to test lighting, to test film, was the Shirley card. Tell me what a Shirley card was.
So Kodak Eastman had a model on staff named Shirley, for which they used as a human face to meter the printed color stock. So she's a pale, white-skinned woman, dark hair that's set against a rather banal background to try and see how white skin fared in a high contrast light situation. So the Shirley cards became a rubric to set up or establish what would be a much more perfected color image.
And in fact, Kodak didn't develop a multiracial card until 1995.
Yes, that is correct. It wasn't so much that Kodak didn't encounter a groundswell of resistance from the African-American community. I think a lot of folks just thought that perhaps the color film was just, you know, they're not very good photographers. So that's probably why the color isn't reading our skin tones in very lighting situations correctly.
Lest anyone think that we're picking on Kodak, you point out that Jean-Luc Godard, for example, refused to use Kodak.
He was very vocal. He was commissioned to film for the Mozambique government. He was commissioned to do a short film. And what was fascinating about Godard's position is that he felt that the film was inherently racist, and said so. His experience with the film stock, and Kodak film stock was more than just what we put inside our cameras. It's also the film stock that was likely used in motion picture making. So for him to recognize that there's a lack of variety and nuance or complexity in dark brown or dark skin images is very telling.
But our technology has improved, and oftentimes we're just not using physical film canisters anymore, right? How does this play into our current discussions about filming and taking pictures of black skin and some of these arguments we've had over, I guess, especially fashion magazines of whether or not they're lightening Beyoncé's skin color, right? They have these arguments all the time.
We do. One of the things I definitely uncovered is that there's been a lack of a conversation, a frank conversation about taking pictures of darker skinned peoples in mixed company.
You mean pairing a black faces
with
white faces?
Yeah, pairing a dark brown, dark, like, and black faces along with, you know, pale, like, light skinned faces. While we're aware of it, because we're all photographers now, and to a certain extent, we're becoming a little bit more versed in terms of how different lighting adjustments affect skin tones and how that looks against each other because of the variety of technology we have available to us. I'd also say that darker skinned people, we're going to be vigilant and sensitive to whether or not there is a lightening that happens when certain celebrities, say a Beyoncé or a Lupita, appear on fashion covers.
I want to be clear. We're not talking about lighten as a with Photoshop. We're talking about actually put lights on the face.
Yeah, I'm talking much more specifically about studio lighting and what the light design is.
You know, the real question is why this all matters, other than obviously doing the best job as a professional photographer. Most of us aren't professional photographers. And I think perhaps the most moving part of your piece was you talking about your early experiences, seeing photos of yourself as a child, and what effect it had on you to see yourself in these pictures as dark, where you could barely make out your features. Why does it matter how well we... I mean, there's white people who, when they're photographed, get completely washed out, right? Why does it matter?
I think it matters because we're talking about a saturation of images of darker-skinned people that somehow we've accepted in our popular culture that kind of diminishes our humanity. And, you know, we're in an era where we're seeing a wider representation of black and brown life, particularly in American life. We've seen so many images of black bodies denigrated, we're rendered as criminals, or we're rendered in a way that doesn't necessarily reflect a kind of normalcy. We see in stock images, whether it's in commercial advertising or on television, we just see images of a normalcy of living and existing that seems to center around whiteness and shows the full variety and humanity of, you know, of white folks or lighter skinned people. And to have to always account for my humanity in situations where people would deal with me one-on-one, but the images they were exposed to said something very different about the kind of community and people I come from, it matters.
Sarita McFadden is a writer, photographer, and regular contributor to Feministing. She joined us from our bureau in New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Beyoncé's catching heat on social media for not taking care of her half-brother. We'll ask our beauty shop ladies if it's a moral obligation or just a case of mo money, mo problems. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves are going after tax refunds by filing fake returns. More at LifeLock.com, code NPR. From the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovative health and mental health programs for underserved populations at Langloth.org. From the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. And from Joyce V. Hale, supporting NPR's internship program, Building a Future, One Opportunity at a Time. This is NPR.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a year ago, we spoke with the head of emergency at Boston Medical Center.
The first patient rolled in. He was near death. He had lost both of his legs, and we started to work on him, and then it was just one after another after another.
A year later, the caregivers still struggle. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
One afternoon, two Mormon missionaries visited the comedian Julia Sweeney.
And they said they had a message for me. From God. I said, well, please, come in. And they looked really happy because I don't think this happens to them all that often.
I'm Guy Raz. Faith, belief, and doubt. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturdays at 3 on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, offering you a chance to explore the intimacy of our technology-driven, fast-paced world in David Rousseff's Reality's new production of Stardust on Saturday, April 26th at 7:30 p.m. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. And it's time yet again for a visit to the beauty shop, where our panel of women journalists and commentators take a fresh cut on the week's news. Sitting in the chairs for a new do this week, Gail Trotter, senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, Bridget Johnson, Washington, D.C. editor of PJ Media. They're both here with me in Washington. And in Philadelphia, we have Veronica Miller, a fashion and pop culture writer for XO Jane and The Griot, and Diana Kelly Saeed, writer and editor of the website Love Inshallah, joins us from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Welcome to everyone.
Thanks for having us.
We want to start off with terror threats. Very much on everybody's mind right now, this because obviously this is the first anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing this week. But let's talk about a terror threat coming from a much more innocuous place to some extent. A 14-year-old girl recently sent this tweet to American Airlines. "Hello, my name's Ibrahim. I'm from Afghanistan. I'm part of Al-Qaeda. And on June 1st, I'm going to do something really big. Bye." This is a 14-year-old Dutch girl. American Airlines, not surprisingly, did not find it funny. They told her they were passing her information and IP address to the authorities. She then apologized on Twitter, saying she's just a white girl, not a terrorist, adding, I always wanted to be famous, but I meant like Demi Lovato famous, not Osama bin Laden famous. Authorities have taken her in for questioning. So, Diana, one of the reactions we're hearing is that there's a real double standard here. As a Muslim American, what do you think? Would it have been different if she were not, as she describes, just a white girl?
Of course it would have been very different. And, you know, I'm a mother of a son named Ibrahim who is part Afghan. So, I mean, that really hits me in the gut when someone makes such assumptions like that. It is very much a double standard. And I think that's what bothers me. It just assumes if you're white, then somehow you're not capable of horrific acts or even poor judgment on Twitter.
Well, I mean, I think we can all agree it's poor judgment on Twitter. But let's go to our mother of six. Your thoughts about this? I mean, my first one was that, you know, maybe her parents should be looking over her Twitter feed.
It's impossible as a parent to totally monitor your children on social media. And when you think about teenagers, they engage in pranks all the time. And we have harmless pranks and we have dangerous pranks. And I think this prank falls in between harmless and dangerous. And I think the authorities were completely correct to vigorously investigate this. The problem is it's not just a harmless prank, because material resources were expended. First responders, law enforcement were distracted from other threats that might have been out there. So this is serious. The authorities need to take into account that she is a teenager, but they need to respond appropriately to discourage other teenagers from doing this.
Well, Gail makes a good point, and it's been worse because since this, dozens of teens in other places have tweeted their own, we assume, fake threats as well. So Veronica, what do you think? Is it just one of those things where social media kind of brings out the stupid in people?
I think it does. I mean, I'm still finding myself trying to wrap my head around this whole thing, because I am still afraid to even type the word terrorism into Google when I'm researching things. So the fact that, you know, these teenagers think it's okay or it's funny to, you know, make these, they're empty threats, but, you know, to make these threats is just mind-boggling to me. And I think there needs to be a serious conversation about the implications of saying something publicly that, you know, sets alarms off, because it's not just a joke. Like, people take these things very seriously. There's a person at Twitter whose job is to make sure people aren't in danger of being killed or being threatened. And, you know, people, even when you're 14 years old, have to be mindful of these things.
And yet, Bridget, people are saying, come on, she's 14 years old. Give her some penalties that'll last the rest of her life. What do you think?
Well, I think she lost a lot of people with the "I'm white, I can't be a terrorist" part. I mean, Al-Qaeda 2.0 is recruiting white people who will not arouse suspicion at checkpoints, etc. And also, there are plenty of terrorists on Twitter. You know, I followed, you know, once, you know, somebody from Al-Shabaab, and Twitter suggested new terrorists for me to follow. I researched the background of all of them. So this is something that they have to take seriously. And so what I would do with this girl, she's Dutch, she's not far from Scotland, I would make her go and sit down with some Pan Am Flight 103 families and realize this is the real world. This is not a game.
Of course, the flight that was taken down by terrorism. Let's turn to another very serious story that touches on terrorism as well. A gunman killed three people last weekend outside two Jewish centers near Kansas City last week. Frazier Glenn Cross, he's now under arrest for the shootings. And authorities plan to charge him with a hate crime, although none of the victims were in fact Jewish. Here's the Overland Park Police Chief John Douglas speaking at a press conference on Monday.
Now, yesterday it became fairly apparent that it was probably a hate crime. But as we told you yesterday, we needed the verification of some investigation to make this determination. It's more than just an opinion. It's actually a legal status. And it took us a while to reach all of the triggers which allow us the opportunity to say officially we believe this to be a hate crime.
Fraser Glenn Cross has been on the radar of some hate watch groups for years. He is believed to have strong connections to the Ku Klux Klan. Look, all kinds of questions come into my mind over this story. Deanna, let me start with you. My first question is, why is this a hate crime and not terrorism? What do you think?
Well, I actually think it is terrorism, and maybe it's time we start to interrogate the language around these two concepts. There is a stream of fundamentalist thought that this man seems to embody that isn't completely dissimilar from the type of fundamentalism that we sometimes attach to the concept of terrorism. So I think we have to revisit that. I mean, to me, it is a case of domestic terrorism.
And, well, Gail, let me take this to you. Often one of the things that we associate with terrorism is religious extremism, though if you're targeting Jews, maybe that this particular crime fits that.
Well, it's fascinating. If you look at the statistics behind the hate crimes law, I think people would be surprised to find out that 65% of victims of hate crimes are male and 61% of victims of hate crimes are white. So it's
Come from the FBI crime?
Yes, that's from the Bureau of Justice Statistics in the DOJ. They have a table 8 of page 7, which has these statistics. And I think people would be surprised about that because the idea of a hate crime is a very powerful rhetorical device. But the truth is, if you're a victim of crime and you're getting abused or hurt or injured or killed, when that happens to you, does it really make a difference that if it's labeled as a hate crime or terrorism? I mean, we're talking about the types of punishment that result from whether it's labeled a hate crime or terrorism. But terrorism in general really deals with more international threats, not as much on the domestic front. And some of the organizations that identify these hate crime organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center in the South has looked at putting these descriptions on their website, and they were implicated in the hate crime that happened at the Family Research Council a few years ago, and the District of Columbia Court recognized that this terrorist who went on to the Family Research Council's office and shot the guard there, he found out about the Family Research Council from the Southern Poverty Law Center. So it has application
beyond. Right, which tracks hate groups. I got to correct you for a second. Actually, terrorism, they don't connect whether it's international or domestic with whether it's terror. Timothy McVeigh, for example, was a domestic terrorist. But I wonder if it matters, Bridget. Does it matter this label whether we put, I mean, as Gail said, you're just prosecuting somebody for a crime.
I think that it could matter with terrorism statutes. We tend to generally define terrorism as a fear-generating attack or plot that has some sort of geopolitical or ideological goal, like the Unabomber, Al-Qaeda's goal of establishing a caliphate. But white supremacist groups who use attacks to further their goal of a white country, of a pure white country, absolutely, I think, should be classified as terrorists.
Let me get your thoughts on this, Veronica, as well.
Yeah, I think it definitely matters because it matters in terms of the public consciousness of, you know, the discussion about the discussion around these crimes. I'm sorry, but it matters in terms of how we talk about what we care about. You know,
right.
We have a war on terror. There's no war on hate. And I think that those labels are important because terrorism in our public consciousness applies to something very specific. It often applies to a very specific group and a very specific threat. And we can all, you know, kind of stand together and say we care about, you know, fighting it. But when it comes to hate, well, we have to prove that somebody hates somebody. And, you know, it doesn't seem like there's much of a public investment in stopping hate on the home front.
Right. You're listening to the Beauty Shop Roundtable. We're talking about some of the week's news. Our guests are Bridget Johnson of PJ Media, pop culture writer Veronica Miller, who you just heard, Deanna Kelly Saeed of the website Love Inshallah, and Gail Trotter of the Independent Women's Forum. Let's turn to some family issues, including an effort to change how and when divorces are granted. Not sure if this story is about love or hate, maybe both. Some social conservative leaders, including former presidential candidate Rick Perry and Rick Santorum, they want to put the brakes on divorce, or at least reduce the number of divorces we have. Lawmakers in about a dozen states have introduced bills to make it harder to get unhitched. They either impose longer waiting periods, they make the couples go to a long period of counseling as well. Deanna Kelly Said, let me go to you first. North Carolina is actually one of the states where spouses have to wait a year before divorcing on the average. What do you think about this?
I think it's amazing that it's quite easy for people, basically heterosexual people, to get married, but it's very hard to get a divorce. And I, you know, in North Carolina, if you are, you know, if you don't have a lot of income, you can't even file for legal separation. So a lot of people are end up being trapped in relationships that are not only unhealthy, but sometimes abusive, and they don't have the resources to get a divorce. And then if you add these extra impediments to being free of a relationship that's not good for you, it's going to cause an increasingly difficult cycle of rebuilding lives and resentment.
Bridget, some of the statistics after no-fault divorce was established show that actually women were safer from both domestic violence and murder after no-fault divorce came into play. What are your thoughts on this? You're a divorcee.
Yes, I'll get a little personal here. You know, I lived in California where Reagan signed the no-fault divorce law before I was born.
1969, I think, yeah.
And when I needed out of a bad marriage in my 20s, thanks to summary dissolution and, you know, not needing to prove any sort of fault in court, I was able to come out of this very, you know, unstable situation and be able to slip away without needlessly aggravating him even more, setting off more abuse, etc., that I think would have happened if I had to go into court and start proving things. Yeah. So I think it does save lives.
Gail, you're a conservative.
Yes, I am.
So what do you think of this effort?
The important thing about our federal system is that it left the states with the power to define marriage. So rather than engage whether any particular possibility that they're looking at considering, you mentioned some of the statutes that they're considering, bills they're considering, it should be left to the states because the states are supposed to be laboratories and they traditionally have the control over the definition of marriage. So if the state is going to be in the marriage business at all, which is a matter of debate right now, and I think it's important for the state to continue to be in the marriage business because the impact on our communities, then we have to let the states decide for themselves through their elected representatives what they think the rules for marriage should be. And we see that the effects of this no-fault easy divorce that have been in effect for almost 40 years in various states, they have unintended consequences on the children of unilateral divorce. They are less well-educated. They end up having lower family incomes. They usually marry earlier and separate more often, and they're more likely to be victims of adult suicide. So there are effects of having no fault divorce that also harm people. And I see these efforts by these state legislators to try and slow down the process because most marriages are low conflict situations that end up in divorce. They're not high conflict situations like she was describing.
Although why, I mean, I assume the question comes to every, you have to move on, but I would assume people would say why slow down the divorce and not slow down the marriage.
Absolutely.
And if we had more time to talk, I'm sure we could all respond to that. But let's move on to our last subject here. Also a story of family strife of one way or another. Social media has been literally abuzz with reports about Beyonce not reaching out a helping hand to a member of her family. Years ago, her father, Matthew Knowles, had a child with a woman who was not his wife. That led to his divorce from Beyonce's mom. That's in the past. The current drama is his child support payments have been reduced. The child and his former mistress may be headed to a homeless shelter. They are supposedly homeless. So people arguing about whether or not Beyonce has a responsibility to help out her half-brother. Let's go to you first, Veronica Miller. Pop culture is your milieu. What do you think here?
Well, the easy answer is Beyonce didn't have a baby with this woman. You know what I mean? She didn't have the affair with this woman. Those two did not create a baby. This is the responsibility of her father. And it seems very suspicious because when this woman, Alexandra Wright, gives interviews, the first name she mentions is Beyonce, even though this child is related to numerous other members of the family, Beyonce's sister Solange. You know, why not ask Miss Tina, you know, Matthew knows his ex-wife for some help. Why not ask Matthew for more help? But it feels very opportunistic, it feels very slimy, and it makes me feel really sad for the child in the middle of all this.
I totally agree with that. Bridget, what do you think here?
Yeah, I mean, what kind of lifestyle has she brought up where she needs $12,000 a month in child support?
That's been reduced to only $2,400 a month.
And you know, I'm thinking, okay, so maybe if Beyonce wants to step in and help, you know, maybe it can be conditional on a network of steps that Wright has to meet as far as, you know, getting a job, setting up quality child care, setting up rental housing, and not looking to married guys for a meal ticket anymore.
That's a good point. I mean, although Beyonce could set up a trust fund with very strong legal limits on what that money could go for. Gail, what do you think here?
This is not a proper use of the public eye. I mean, this is for Beyonce to handle. It's her family situation. And just because she's an amazing artist, and obviously I don't share her politics, that shouldn't be an excuse for all of us to jump in and say how she should order her family relationships.
Oh, come on. We all should jump in forever, right, Deanna? I mean, nothing's
safe.
Well,
I don't feel like I don't know those family dynamics, but I do think that just because someone has money, they can't pay for the acts of the father.
There you go. Okay, well, we'll leave.
I can't jump in and say that because I'm the Beyonce expert, but she has gone on record to say she doesn't have a relationship with her father anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, that can play a part in that, too.
And one of the reasons the child support went down is because he lost his job as manager.
As her manager.
So, yeah, right. Yes. All right, you just heard Veronica Miller, fashion and pop culture writer for XO Jane and The Griot. Also, Deanna Kelly Said is a writer and editor of the website Love Inshallah here in D.C. with me. We had Bridget Johnson, Washington, D.C. editor of PJ Media, and Gail Trotter, senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
All right. Next time, Gail, we won't talk about Beyonce. That is our program for today. I'm Celeste Headlee. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News, and we will talk more tomorrow.